It should have been a simple test. The wormhole stretched from the moon's orbit to an empty patch of space near Neptune, where a welcome party was already being arranged. It had taken huge effort and resources to reach down into the quantum foam and pluck a wormhole from those depths, but general relativity had predicted their existence, and now, here it was. With this technology, humanity could finally achieve the dream of interstellar travel. And so, after the last calibrations and tweaks, the ship and its brave crew entered the wormhole's throat, passing easily through the sphere of the entrance. Onlookers could see the retreating vessel gradually shrinking away as it appeared to move effortlessly to its destination, 4.5 billion kilometers away. At the other end, the reception party could see the ship approaching, slowly getting larger as the minutes ticked by. The test probe had taken roughly 30 minutes to traverse the distance, and the manned vessel seemed to be on a similar track. But then, there were murmurs of concern as the ship appeared to slow down, then stall. It looked frozen in place. 30 minutes passed, and the ship did not emerge. Days passed, then weeks, then months. With time, sensitive telescopes at either end were able to determine that the ship was still in motion, but almost imperceptibly slowly. Debates raged about what to do. Send a rescue party? Turn off the wormhole generator? Every option seemed to end in tragedy, with the fragile balance of exotic forces maintaining the stability of the wormhole thrown into disequilibrium, tearing the ship and its crew to pieces. The only safe option was to wait. And so, they waited. 500 years passed before what was left of the ship finally emerged from the open end of the wormhole. It was still intact, but barely functioning, a broken husk after years of exposure to the harsh conditions within. The crew was long dead, their remains still strapped into the command chairs. Finally, the wormhole was shut down. Clearly, they had miscalculated. The predictions of general relativity were evidently not enough. They thought they had solved every corner of the complex intersection of gravity and quantum mechanics, accounted for every possible interaction. But something simply hadn't worked. Humanity looked out at the distant stars and never felt more alone. Wormholes are complicated. They appear in the equations of general relativity, and the idea of them is almost as old as the theory itself. But unfortunately for those test pilots heading to Neptune, relativity is just a machine that tells us how gravity works in various scenarios, regardless of whether or not the universe actually allows those scenarios. And so, what would it take to build a wormhole? Which mechanisms allow for wormholes and which forbid them? And would they transport us to the destinations of our dreams across the stars, or to an early death? Critics called it confusing, dense, and absurd. But to Edgar Allan Poe, it was his greatest work yet. It was 1848, just 1 year before his mysterious death. Having struggled as a professional writer throughout much of his life, his recent success from The Raven had been a welcome financial reprieve, which he took advantage of to compose what he viewed as his masterpiece, what he called The One Great Purpose in My Literary Life. Its title was Eureka. The text is expansive, and today little attention is paid to it, especially compared to his much more famous poems. But some statements in its tangled mass still stand out as oddly prescient. For about two-thirds of the way through the text, in the middle of a section where Poe discusses the expanses of interstellar space, he declares, almost out of nowhere, that space and duration are one. In Poe's eyes, space and time were the same. Working nearly a century later, Albert Einstein had no idea that in some sense he was recapitulating the thoughts of a long-dead New England poet. But that is exactly what he ended up doing. It was 1905, a year which would become known as Einstein's Annus Mirabilis, a year of miracles. In that single year, Einstein published 5 papers, each one with huge implications for our reality. And one of those papers, perhaps his most consequential, concerned the relationship between movement and energy. It's in this paper that Einstein formulated his special theory of relativity, which showed that the measurements of length and time were relative to the observer. But Einstein's former teacher, Hermann Minkowski, thought that he hadn't gone far enough. And so shortly after, Minkowski offered an intuitive, geometric formulation of Einstein's work, presenting the universe as a 4-dimensional object. Unlike Poe's ideas, however, this new space-time did not mean that space and time were identical. Instead, they were different facets of a single, unified entity. But Einstein would learn from his teacher once more, and quickly adopted this new idea, using it to make one more gigantic leap in human imagination. In 1915, Einstein unleashed into the unsuspecting world a general theory of relativity. In the language of general relativity, space-time isn't static. It responds to the presence of matter and energy. The unified fabric of space-time bends and warps due to matter's influence, and in return, that bending of space-time influences the motion of matter. Indeed, years later, famed physicist John Wheeler would sum it all up with the simple phrase, "Matter tells space how to curve, and space tells matter how to move." And it's happening all around you and within you, right now. Ripples of gravity, known as gravitational waves, constantly slosh over the Earth, created by distant cataclysmic events. As they pass, they deform space. If you were to measure it down to the level of an atomic nucleus, you could feel yourself being gently stretched and squeezed by those passing waves. Much like Poe's writings, the theory of general relativity itself is beautiful, haunting, and sometimes complex and confusing. This is because general relativity is more than a simple physical theory of nature. General relativity is a machine. You start with an input, a particular arrangement of matter. Then you feed it into the equations of relativity, and out pops an answer, a prediction for how that matter will behave under the influence of its own gravity. But general relativity doesn't tell you whether that arrangement of matter is real or not. It's up to you to decide what is possible and what is impossible. Indeed, relativity is not alone in physics when it comes to this. Newton's law of universal gravitation, which relativity replaced, was similar. You tell Newton what kind of material arrangement you have, and the equations will tell you how that system behaves. If you want realistic answers, you have to provide realistic scenarios. For example, you could, in principle, figure out the gravitational influence of a solid metal rod 10,000 light-years long. It's up to you to decide if light-year-long solid metal rods exist in the universe. On that matter, Newton will remain silent. But to make matters even more complicated, unlike Newton's laws that preceded it, general relativity is not a simple equation that could be taught in high school. Instead, it's a set of 10 equations in 4 dimensions, all tangled with each other, and all non-linear. The physics community knew that it was correct and useful, but it was so difficult to wrangle that most physicists preferred instead to work on subatomic and astrophysical problems. Indeed, the pioneering physicist J.J. Thomson once remarked, "I have to confess that no one has succeeded in stating in clear language what the theory of Einstein's really is." though there was some progress. Soon after Einstein developed relativity, Karl Schwarzschild found a solution involving the simplest arrangement of matter possible while cowering in the trenches of World War I. In this case, Schwarzschild took the machine of relativity and input something resembling the solar system. Out popped a description of the strength of gravity surrounding the Sun. While the solution was intended to mimic the solar system, it contained something else: the possibility of a singularity. The idea that if the ball of matter were to be squeezed below a certain limit, then it would just keep collapsing, its own gravitational pull so strong that it becomes a singular point of infinite density, surrounded by a one-way membrane, an event horizon. And so the machine of relativity had done its job. Now it was up to physicists to figure out whether the result was possible or not. And most scoffed at the idea. Indeed, Einstein himself rejected it. In a 1939 paper, he argued that no object could ever shrink to the degree that gravity would win out over all the other forces. Frozen stars, as they were named at the time, simply could not exist in the universe. But J. Robert Oppenheimer disagreed. Just a few months after Einstein's publication, Oppenheimer was working with his student Hartland Snyder. He had just figured out the maximum possible mass of a neutron star, the densest star possible, and he wondered what would happen to those stars if they went over the mass limit. But Oppenheimer and Snyder came to the exact opposite conclusion to Einstein. Once you folded in the rest of our knowledge of physics, they found that there was really nothing to stop the infinite gravitational collapse of a massive enough star. And from there, the machine of general relativity told you exactly what would happen, their paper stating clearly, "The star thus tends to close itself off from any communication with a distant observer. Only its gravitational field persists." However, the same day that the duo published their paper, Germany invaded Poland. Their work would be forgotten for decades, and Oppenheimer himself would get swept up in the Manhattan Project and the fraught politics that ensued, never to return to astrophysical mysteries. Despite this, as time went on, it would become indisputable. Black holes were real and possible. But was that all that the machine of relativity predicted? Or was there something more? As Oppenheimer worked away in service of the United States government, behind the Iron Curtain, Soviet astronomer Igor Novikov saw something else produced by the equations. The black hole had a twin. Novikov had been born in 1935 in Moscow and quickly ascended to leading positions at Moscow universities. Little is known about his personal life, except that working as a physicist in that environment was a tricky business. You had to ensure that your research did not conflict with Soviet ideology, you would frequently get pulled aside to work on some state-sponsored priority, and you had little hope of making your work known to the worldwide community of scientists. Still, Novikov had enough freedom to pursue some decidedly unorthodox lines of research. And his great revelation in 1964 was born out of a simple realization about gravity. Imagine if we took a video of you tossing a ball up in the air and catching it. But we will be clever about the framing so we don't see your hand, just the ball going up and down. If we were to play back that video in reverse, would you notice? Both the forward and backward playthrough would look identical, just a ball going up and down. The mathematics of relativity are similar. They don't know if processes are going forwards or backwards in time. Once again, it's up to you to decide which is which. Gravity, including general relativity, doesn't care about time. And a black hole is a particular solution to general relativity. In 1964, Novikov realized that the equations of black holes could be run in reverse. Instead of trapping particles forever, they could eject particles forever. Instead of a black hole, it could be a white hole. Novikov had proposed this idea to explain mysterious bright sources appearing in astronomical surveys, but as he was in the Soviet Union and behind the Iron Curtain, his work was largely ignored by Western scientists. And white holes would be very strange beasts indeed, perhaps even stranger than black holes. They would still have singularities at their centers, but they would be surrounded by the opposite of an event horizon, an anti-horizon. They would still have mass, and so you would still be gravitationally attracted to one, but you could never enter. The anti-horizon forbids passage into the white hole, just like a black hole's event horizon forbids travel outwards. However, if you found yourself inside of a white hole when it first formed, you would not stay there for long. You would find yourself propelled outwards faster than the speed of light, like a flooding river that you can't resist until you exited the white hole. The white hole would continue spewing matter and radiation until it was completely empty, finally consisting of nothing more than a bare singularity and its anti-horizon. And if this is not strange enough, white holes can only have been formed in the past and are now exploding outwards. The exact time reversal mirror of a black hole. In time, physicists would prefer a different explanation for those distant bright sources, namely the energies emitted by matter as it fell into black holes. But as late as 2014, Novikov believed that some of them may still be white holes, formed through some exotic mechanism in the early universe and still shining today. While most physicists disregarded the possibility of a white hole, a few were intrigued. Roger Penrose, who would go on to win a Nobel Prize for his work on black holes, became aware of Novikov's work and realized that it might just be the ingredient needed to explain yet another strange solution in general relativity, a solution involving a tunnel from one universe to the next. But it would be Penrose's friend and colleague, John Wheeler, who would give these tunnels their modern name, wormholes. He would find that white holes and black holes could be connected together, and in fact, the solution had already been found decades earlier by a relatively unknown assistant of Einstein's. And with that solution in place, Wheeler realized that a little branch of relativity could blossom into a way to jump light years into the stars. He just needed to see if the machine of general relativity was spitting out genius or madness. Roughly a dozen people from countries across Europe and North America, men and women. They would peer deeply into the inner workings of nature. They would devise ingenious mathematical proofs. They would conjure results from groundbreaking experiments. They were all, in a word, geniuses. But they all had the same inescapable problem. They lived in the shadow of Albert Einstein. Like being the second best swimmer in a pool next to Michael Phelps, there was no hope for Einstein's collaborators in claiming top prize as the smartest person in the room. But still, Einstein himself did not disparage them or hold them in disregard. Instead, he frequently asked them for help. Einstein called one friend, Michel Besseau, the best sounding board in Europe, and one of these working relationships became personal as well, his first wife, Mileva Maric. And then, there was Nathan Rosen. He would meet Einstein for the first time in 1934 at the Institute for Advanced Studies, which had been founded on the grounds of Princeton a few years prior. Rosen was smart, capable, and hard-working. He'd even proposed a largely correct model for the atomic nucleus before its discovery. But despite his intellect and other work, it's unlikely his name would be repeated so often today if it weren't for his collaborations with Einstein. Rosen had already spent a few months at Princeton before he finally built up the courage to meet with the legendary physicist. When he did, timidly knocking on the genius's door, Einstein was engaged in a deep conversation with another collaborator, the mathematician Walter Meyer. But immediately, Einstein put the young Rosen at ease, as Rosen himself related years later. I told him about my work on the solutions of the equations of his unified field theories, and he seemed interested and asked many questions. After a while, he began telling me about the work he was doing at the time, and before I realized it, the three of us were engaged in a lively discussion of his current problems. What followed was a three-year partnership. Officially, Rosen was Einstein's clerk, but their relationship was closer to a friendship. Rosen was especially interested in Einstein's doomed efforts to unify gravity with electromagnetism, something most other physicists scoffed at as foolish and misguided, which probably helped their bond. And it was during their time together that Rosen would propose a remarkable new outcome from the machine of relativity. At that time, Einstein had been particularly frustrated by the appearance of singularities in his theories. As well as this, he was equally frustrated by the growing trend of viewing subatomic particles as having no size, no spatial extent. He'd sought a way to eliminate both problems, and Rosen came up with a way to do it. Rosen and Einstein imagined following the path of a line as it fell into a black hole and crossed the event horizon. Normally, we would consider this the end of the story. The line crosses the event horizon, is sealed off from the rest of the universe forever, and meets its ultimate fate at the singularity in the center. But Rosen had a radical suggestion. What if the line could keep going? What geometric construction would allow them to avoid the singularity altogether? It was an intriguing question, and Rosen had just the machine to answer it. General relativity. Rosen found that if you followed this path, you would end up back in the universe, but not where you started. The path would form a bridge between two different regions of the universe. There could be multiple paths, even shortcuts, within space-time. To complete their theory, Rosen and Einstein added electromagnetic fields to the calculations, hoping that this solution that eliminated singularities could also explain the appearance and properties of subatomic particles. In other words, to describe particles as these bridges in space-time. Unfortunately, the attempt did not work. And so these Einstein-Rosen bridges, as they came to be known, fell into relative obscurity. And so, it would be a further 2 decades before American physicist John Archibald Wheeler would resurrect this obscure idea of Nathan Rosen's and give the bridges a new name. Wormholes. Wheeler had had an appetite for norm-defying questions since his youth. His mother recounted that one day when he was 4 years old and splashing around in a bathtub, he went suddenly still, looked up at her, and asked, "What happens when you get to the end of things?" And indeed, he never let go of that childhood curiosity and some childhood mannerisms, including a particular joy in racing down flights of stairs as quickly as he could. And it was this boundless energy that allowed him to investigate questions that nobody else dared to explore, including the mysterious bridges of Rosen and Einstein. For it was Wheeler that realized they might provide a mechanism for interstellar travel, that the bridges were no mere mathematical construct, but a tunnel in space-time that could be shortened. In principle, you could travel to distant stars with no more effort than a leisurely stroll, or a race down a flight of stairs. But, almost immediately after this revelation, he then realized that if you attempted to travel through a wormhole, you would be instantly obliterated. Rosen and Einstein had imagined traveling into a black hole without suffering the ultimate fate of the singularity and instead emerging somewhere else, safe and sound. In this sense, the other end of their bridge was a white hole, the mirror image of a black hole. Wheeler, who was one of the few to become aware of Novikov's work in the Soviet Union, realized that there was nothing in the mathematics of general relativity to prevent the existence of such an eternal black hole, a tunnel in space-time with a black hole at one end and a white hole at the other. Problem solved? Not quite. For these wormholes suffered from 2 fatal flaws. The first is that general relativity is not the only theory of physics. There is more to the universe than pure gravity. The second is that just because a wormhole can be created, it doesn't automatically mean that it will stick around. For decades, physicists had struggled with the concept of black holes and the vexing problems that they brought up. But eventually, evidence would win the day, and now all physicists accept their reality. However, this is not the case for white holes. A white hole is a black hole run in reverse, which is possible in general relativity only because general relativity does not care about the flow of time. But we do. And so do other theories of physics. The cast iron laws of thermodynamics, for example, do care about the flow of time and the rise of entropy. You can collapse material to form a black hole, the entropy increases and all is well in the universe. But you cannot expand material to form a white hole. The entropy would have to be lowered to make this happen, and that is strictly forbidden. There is no mechanism to create a white hole out of the materials and physics of the known universe. When a star collapses, the rush of energies and forces prohibits one from forming, in a sense pinching off that portion of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, leaving only the black hole behind. Perhaps, though, the early universe, chock full of strange and unknown physics, was able to create white holes from some exotic process and leave them behind as remnants that inhabit the modern-day universe. Could that be the solution? Unfortunately, no. Even if you were able to create a white hole, either through some arcane mechanism in the Big Bang or in the laboratory, it could not last for long. A white hole still has positive mass. It still has a singularity at its center. If you were to encounter it, you would still be drawn towards its massive gravity, but you couldn't ever enter. Its anti-horizon is the ultimate exclusive club. It does not admit entry. To anybody, to anything. And so, you would become trapped, pulled tantalizingly closer to the edge of the anti-horizon, but never able to pass through. The energies of this system, of you approaching infinitesimally closer to the anti-horizon, go up and up and up, and eventually, they go out of control. To put it simply, they explode. And so, there is no known mechanism that can create a white hole, and once formed, there is no known mechanism that can keep it stable. For these reasons, understandably, physicists do not believe that white holes exist in nature. Unlike their twins, the black holes, they are destined to be nothing more than flights of mathematical fancy embedded in Einstein's relativity. But dreamers like Wheeler and Novikov aren't constrained by a single theory. After all, we've updated our understanding of gravity in the past, and we expect, or at least hope, to update the general theory of relativity in the future. So while our current knowledge of physics forbids the existence of white holes, maybe a more nuanced approach could allow them. Maybe wormholes could be possible. But unfortunately, even if you could achieve some feat of magical technology to create a white hole and keep it open, turning it into the open end of an Einstein-Rosen bridge, we'd have found that you should never, ever enter it. The problem is that the description of space-time offered by Einstein and Rosen, what we now call an eternal black hole, is static. A simple description of geometry, frozen in time, forever. But as John Wheeler, at the age of 4, asked his mother, what happens when you go to the end of things? What would happen if you created this wormhole and actually travelled through it? The interiors of wormholes are not pleasant places. They are not serene tunnels through gentle space-time. They would be regions of intense, voracious gravity. Gravity can do more than just pull straight inwards. It can also tear. Indeed, the moon attempts to gently tear the Earth apart with every rotation, which we recognize as the tides. An object falling into a black hole is stretched and thinned before being atomized, a process physicists call spaghettification. And the gravitational forces inside a wormhole are also so strong, so intense, so tortured, that if one were to form, it would be compelled to stretch along its length and compress across its middle, like a rubber band stretched too far, wormholes would simply rip themselves apart in a flurry of gravitational energies. In fact, Wheeler found that this destructive process happens faster than the speed of light. Nothing, not even light, can travel through the throat of a wormhole and safely emerge from the other end before the tunnel destroys itself. Briefly, you might glimpse a view of your destination. Light from either end of the wormhole can fall in. You could see the universe at both your origin and your endpoint. If someone entered from the opposite end, you could meet inside the wormhole tunnel. You could share stories and experiences from across the entire universe. And then the wormhole would collapse, and you would be left inside the black hole. Its singularity, your only possible destination. You would die. And so, after Wheeler's pronouncement of the finality of wormholes, most physicists accepted that they were literal dead ends. It was clear, once you crossed the event horizon of a black hole, whether as a single entity or as the entrance to a wormhole, you could not escape. No clever trick of Einstein and Rosen's geometry could save you. But, predictably, that wasn't quite the end. For decades later, a third generation of physicists would take up the challenge posed by Einstein, Rosen, and Wheeler. And in fact, it would be one of Wheeler's own students who would find a way to create a stable, traversable wormhole. He just needed a little help from science fiction. If you're looking for good physics in science fiction, movies like Star Wars are not the best place to find it. Laser beams that travel slower than real-life bullets, gigantic moon-sized space stations that defy their own gravity, weapons powerful enough to obliterate entire planets, and, of course, spaceships that, with a simple flick of a switch, can travel faster than the speed of light. While Star Wars makes for great entertainment, it doesn't have the best grounding in known physics. But sometimes a writer or director comes along who wants to hew a little closer to our modern understanding of how the universe works. And one example of this is the film Interstellar, directed by Christopher Nolan. The world of Interstellar is recognizable enough, with a crop-destroying disease standing in for the ravages of climate change, and NASA, a shadow of its former glory, trying to organize a mission to explore a mysterious object that has appeared in the outer solar system. But despite this attention to real-life world-building, Nolan wanted his crew of astronauts to travel vast distances in short amounts of time. And so he enlisted Kip Thorne, a physicist, expert in general relativity, and Nobel Prize winner, to help with ideas. Thorne tells the story. Chris considered traveling through space faster than the speed of light as non-negotiable. He used that phrase in our brainstorms. But in the end, after in-depth discussions, he came around. Faster than light travel was out of the question for Thorne, but rather than refusing Nolan entirely, he compromised and provided a possible solution. The physicist suggested a wormhole, a shortcut through space and time that was stable and traversable. A bit of fantastical technology, certainly, but one that was not entirely ruled out by modern physics. And indeed, if anybody, Thorne should have known. For it was Thorne himself who realized this when in the 1980s he was helping out another famous friend of his, the legendary science communicator Carl Sagan, with his own fictional story. In Sagan's novel Contact, humanity receives a set of instructions on how to build a wormhole, and a team travels through it. In one exchange of dialogue, Sagan wanted his characters to muse on how it might be possible, but he didn't know what the characters should say. So he, like Nolan later would, turned to Thorne for help. Of course, by that time, wormholes were already known to be catastrophically unstable. so Thorn and his collaborators came up with a way to stabilize them. The idea was never intended as a serious venture into theoretical physics. Indeed, his 1988 paper on the subject, co-authored with Michael Morris, was titled Wormholes in Space-Time and Their Use for Interstellar Travel, and subtitled A Tool for Teaching General Relativity. For Thorn, this was business as usual. He once said in an interview, "Almost everything that I have done was something I never planned to do." It was clear that the wormholes of Rosen, Einstein, and Wheeler simply didn't work. White holes aren't stable, assuming they can be made at all, and the bridges they form with black holes are only temporary. And so to make a wormhole useful, in Thorne's jargon, traversable, you have to solve two problems at once. One, you have to put the entrance to the wormhole outside the black hole's event horizon. That's the only way to avoid doom at the singularity. And secondly, you have to stabilize the passage itself, exerting some sort of pressure on the walls so that they don't just collapse in an instant. And Thorn found one simple trick of the universe that could solve both problems within the equations of general relativity. Normally, most physicists use general relativity in one direction. Given an arrangement of matter and energy, they use the equations to calculate what the resulting curvature in space-time is. From there, you can calculate the gravitational forces and predict the future behavior of the system. But Thorn worked the equations in reverse. He started with a specific structure in space-time, the wormhole bridge between two regions of the universe, and asked the equations what configuration of matter and energy is required to make that tunnel stable. Ever dutiful, ignorant of what is and is not possible in the real universe, the machine of relativity obliged and produced an answer. Negative mass. Not antimatter, which has positive mass but opposite charge. Negative mass. A football that weighs negative 500 grams. A cut of meat from the grocer that weighs negative 2 kilograms. Negative mass doesn't pull and attract, it pushes and repels. If you fashion negative mass into a shell, space-time around it responds, pushing itself apart. This pressure can inflate the entrance of a wormhole to sit beyond the event horizon, allowing you to enter the tunnel without being swallowed by the black hole at its heart. That same pressure of the negative mass keeps the tunnel open, resisting its natural inclination to tear itself apart, and allowing objects, light, particles, spaceships, to travel through. There it was, the key to a working wormhole, laid bare in the cold mathematics of relativity. There was one problem, though. Where could we find negative mass? Despite decades of searches and experiments, physicists and astronomers have found no sign of matter with negative mass, dubbed exotic matter. And indeed, even if it did exist, it would pose severe problems for our most fundamental and cherished conceptions of momentum and energy. For example, exotic matter might behave in the opposite manner in response to forces. If you kicked a football with negative mass, it would go flying backwards, not forwards. If you dropped it, it would go flying up into the sky. Exotic matter would break our understanding of the conservation of momentum, the foundational principle behind almost every single theory of modern physics. Of course, it's perfectly possible for momentum conservation to be wrong, or at least inadequate, but after centuries of investigation, it has shown no signs of weakness, no cracks in its ability to explain how the universe behaves. And so exotic matter seems to be a dead end. But Einstein did show us that matter and energy are merely two sides of the same coin. So if exotic matter can't be made and fashioned into a wormhole, perhaps exotic energy could do the trick. And exotic energy found its beginnings in an old-fashioned shootout. It was just after World War II, and the streets of Copenhagen were standing in for the dusty thoroughfares of the Old West. Suit-wearing cowboys wielded mock weapons and entered into simulated duels with each other. One would have the choice to draw their weapon whenever they chose. The other had to wait for the opponents before they could make a move. One such participant was Hendrik Casimir, a young graduate student who was more interested in particle physics than fake gunfights. And watching over all of this odd experiment, stopwatch and notebook in hand, was none other than Niels Bohr, the godfather of quantum physics. Casimir was in Copenhagen to work on quantum mechanics, but Bohr had diverted from his main interests to briefly indulge a hypothesis he had created, known today as the gunslinger effect. He believed that automatic responses were faster than intentional ones and had wanted to test the idea. Reluctantly or not, Casimir had had to take a break from his studies and pretend to be a gunfighter. And so perhaps that image of fellow graduate students staring at each other across a distance, pretend guns ready at the hip, stuck with him as he returned to hard physics and imagined the tension and forces between two metal plates held a small distance apart. Studying the effects of quantum mechanics under Bohr, his calculations had shown a remarkable property. With nothing between two metal plates at all, they would spontaneously move towards each other, as if willed together by an invisible, new force. But this would turn out to be no new force of nature. It was instead an artifact of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics does not envision a universe full of particles. Instead, it sees fields that occupy all of space and time. They are everywhere. These fields are full of vibrations, constantly fizzling in and out of existence. Sometimes these vibrations take on more substance and travel. This is what we call a particle. But most simply disappear before they can be noticed by the wider cosmos. And there are, in fact, infinitely many vibrations occurring all throughout the expanse of the universe. However, between the plates, those vibrations are restricted. Through careful calculations, Casimir was able to show that the difference in vibrations, outside and inside of the plates, led to a gentle push, a force that would impel the plates to come together. And since the region inside the plates had less energy than the average energy of the vacuum, it could be said that the Casimir effect, which was named in his honor, is an expression of negative energy. And a sufficient concentration of negative energy can hold open a wormhole, stabilize it, and allow it to be traveled through. Such a wormhole would be a thing of wonder, completely unlike anything else observed in the universe. Its entrance would be a sphere, not unlike the event horizon of a black hole, meaning you could enter the wormhole from any direction. But it would be ablaze with light, not the light of the surrounding stars, but the light from a distant portion of the universe that has filtered through the opposite end. You could wave hello to a friend in the Andromeda Galaxy, you could examine its stellar contents, and you could travel there yourself. Movement through this wormhole would be relatively stress-free, assuming that the tunnel was properly stabilized with an adequate arrangement of negative energy. You would experience no strong tidal distortions, no incredible warpings of gravity. Although your view of the outside universe would be highly distorted due to the unique geometry of the wormhole tunnel. But you would pass through unscathed, skipping tens, hundreds, millions of light years without a hitch. At least, in principle. For once again, things are not quite as straightforward as they seem. We have laws of physics, like the general theory of relativity. But usually, the maths within these laws has much broader scope than just our physical universe. For example, some solutions to relativity are permitted in our universe, like black holes, while others, like white holes, are not. And so, to help navigate this, over the decades, physicists have developed a set of rules to guide which solutions are permitted and which are not. These rules are called energy conditions. There are various, like the strong, dominant, and weak conditions, and in general, they tell us how energy can behave. For example, energy cannot travel faster than light, just like matter. Another condition states that local mass cannot be negative. Exotic matter is simply not allowed due to its momentum-defying implications. Yet another condition says that local gravity must always be attractive. There may be repulsion, as we see with the accelerated expansion of the universe, but that cannot happen at small scales. The Casimir effect violates the weak energy condition, the rule that energy must always be positive. But of course, this is only true in the hyperlocal space between the plates. If you average out over a larger volume, including the plates and surrounding environment, total energy is positive and the energy condition is restored. It is an open question in physics if any of these energy conditions can be violated at large scales. They seem to hold true, but again, they are only guesses based on our experience with gravity. It is possible that strange quantum oddities like the Casimir effect could be amplified by a sufficiently advanced civilization. Indeed, quantum theory predicts the existence of numerous, even infinite, wormholes. The same quantum fields that constantly vibrate and fizzle in and out of existence give rise to an invisible sea of particles, which in turn disturb and disrupt space-time at the tiniest scales. This is called the quantum foam. A roiling sea of broken and unruly space-time operating at such small scales in time and space that they escape notice. That foam contains countless sub-microscopic wormholes, and so perhaps, as Thorne mused in his 1988 paper, an advanced civilization could take one of these ultra-tiny wormholes and pluck them out of the quantum foam, carefully enlarging them to macroscopic proportions. Perhaps they could find a way to violate the energy conditions at large scales, allowing a Casimir-like effect to go from minute distances between plates to span intergalactic lengths. And perhaps that civilization could use that technology to allow a brave crew to travel to distant stars. But a functioning wormhole, as tantalizing as it sounds, is more than a bridge to faraway galaxies. It is also a tunnel into the past. You receive an invitation to a party. The location is the University of Cambridge. If you need more precision, the coordinates of the party are at 52 degrees, 12 minutes, 21 seconds north, and 0 degrees, 7 minutes, 4.7 seconds east. And the party takes place precisely at 12 noon Universal Time on the 28th of June in the year 2009. There will be champagne, and your host is none other than famed astrophysicist Stephen Hawking. At that precise place, and more importantly, time, Hawking arrived at the room he had reserved. He sipped some of the champagne and waited, and after several hours of nobody showing up, he departed. And then, and only then, after the party had concluded, did he distribute his invitations. It was a party for time travelers. The lack of guests seemed to be reasonable experimental evidence to show that time travel was not possible. After all, who in the distant future would turn down an opportunity to meet Stephen Hawking? But Hawking himself was not totally dissuaded. I'm hoping copies of the invitation, in one form or another, will survive for many thousands of years. Maybe one day, someone living in the future will find the information and use a wormhole time machine to come back to my party, proving that time travel will one day be possible. And so was he correct? Could wormholes hold the key to time travel? As far as we can observe, time travel into the past is impossible. And yet, once again, the machine of relativity seems to throw a spanner in the works, as its equations permit it. Let's assume that our knowledge of physics advances from its present state, and we discover a way to violate the energy conditions and construct a working, traversable wormhole held open by exotic matter or negative energy. You build your device and bounce between the stars faster than light. Never locally, of course. You never, ever measure yourself moving faster than light, in accordance with relativity, and yet, at the same time, you are able to arrive at your destination before the news of your departure reaches it. You then take one end of your wormhole and accelerate it to nearly the speed of light. Indeed, it doesn't matter where you take it, what matters is that it's fast. Due to special relativity, that end of the wormhole experiences time dilation, its clock becoming unsynchronized with the other end. And so, if you travel outside the wormhole, back to the other, non-accelerated end and travel through, if your journey time outside the wormhole is less than the difference in time between the two ends, you can arrive before you leave. Wormholes aren't just shortcuts in space, they are shortcuts through time. If the universe allows us to build wormholes, it automatically means that it allows us to build time machines. But time travel opens up so many paradoxes that most physicists point to this reason as sufficient evidence that wormholes are impossible. But why? Why can't we travel through time? Consider this example. You have a machine that creates a wormhole. You can turn the wormhole on, you can also turn the wormhole off. So you turn the wormhole on and travel into the past. Then you turn the wormhole off. Or you detonate a bomb and destroy the entire wormhole-making machine entirely. But if the wormhole is off, or destroyed, how are you able to travel into the past to turn it off? This is just one example of the myriad paradoxes inherent to time travel. And so anyone who has deeply studied wormholes has been forced to confront the difficulties of time travel and concoct solutions around it. Novikov himself, the father of white holes, created the self-consistency principle. He suggested that perhaps time travel is allowed, but only in certain limited cases where the past remains unchanged. For example, you throw an asteroid towards the entrance of a wormhole, but at the last minute, just before entering, another asteroid comes flying in, knocking yours off course. It still flies into the wormhole, but at a trajectory you did not anticipate. The asteroid travels through the wormhole and emerges out the other end, in its own past, only to collide with itself just before entering the wormhole. And so the history of the universe remains consistent, with the past unchanged. Some unknown mechanism prevents the past from being altered. But other physicists rejected the idea of time travel altogether. Indeed, in a 1992 paper, Stephen Hawking himself said, "It seems that there is a chronology protection agency which prevents the appearance of closed time-like curves and so makes the universe safe for historians." Hawking's chronology protection conjecture states flatly that time travel is forbidden. Instead of trying to find a way to allow wormholes and thus time travel to exist, we should instead use the information provided that time travel appears to be forbidden as a guide to building an improved theory of quantum gravity. And yet still, that is not quite the end of it. For perhaps wormholes are not tunnels into the past, but bridges to entirely different universes. In the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics espoused by Hugh Everett, every quantum interaction leads to a branching multiverse. For example, if we perform an experiment that has a 50-50 chance between two outcomes, one universe, with one set of us's, measures one result, while another universe, with another set of us's, measures the other result. This interpretation of quantum mechanics has many flaws, but is not definitively ruled out by any experiment. And it opens up the possibility that wormholes could allow us to travel to the other branches of the infinitely expanding and splitting quantum tree. Following this logic, perhaps there is a universe out there in the many worlds where revelers from the future did arrive at Hawking's party. In their universe, Hawking's party was always a success. In ours, always a failure. Hawking's chronology protection conjecture holds, and time travel is still allowed. And so, the presence of wormholes in the equations of general relativity opens up a whole range of intriguing, tantalizing possibilities. The ability to leapfrog amongst the stars, the capacity to jump into our own pasts. Perhaps wormholes are forbidden by some yet-to-be-known laws of gravity. Perhaps they are allowed but contain hidden flaws and hidden traps. Or perhaps they are just too slow. In 2019, a team of researchers at Harvard University and the Institute for Advanced Study, the same place where Rosen met Einstein nearly a century before, found a way to concoct wormholes without needing exotic energy. But there was just one catch. These wormholes took much longer than expected. They weren't working with a model of gravity applicable to our universe. Instead, they were focused on a special sort of space-time that only has two spatial dimensions and one of time. Surprisingly, this wormhole requires no exotic matter to stabilize it. Gravity itself takes on a repulsive character in the extreme geometries of the wormhole tunnel, which is more than enough to hold it open and allow for passage. But an analysis of that same geometry revealed that such a tunnel could not be used to skip around the universe faster than light. Indeed, paths flowing into the wormhole were even slower and longer than paths that remained in flat space. Not only was this wormhole a poor way to traverse the cosmos, it was worse than not building one at all. Admittedly, the researchers had used a modified structure of space-time to study this wormhole, a structure that is not the same as the physical universe. But it still leads to the intriguing, if frustrating, idea that wormholes may very well be possible, but they also may very well be useless. Despite these recent discoveries, in general, in our universe, the current consensus among most physicists is that, ultimately, wormholes are not allowed. But they can still serve as useful playgrounds to test new ideas in gravity and quantum mechanics, to study physics in one of its most extreme configurations imaginable, to use their strange behaviors as a probe not into unknown regions of the universe, but into the corners of knowledge currently hidden from us. As Stephen Hawking said when reflecting on the difficulties of understanding wormholes, time travel, and quantum gravity, not only does God play dice, but he sometimes throws them where they cannot be seen. You've been watching The Entire History of the Universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.